What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Media 1099. It is Season 3, Episode 93, and we are doing the third version of the Media 1099 Book Club, where we talk about what we're reading, what we're interested in, and we will get right to it right after a word from our sponsors. All right, so welcome back, folks. It is the third episode that we're going to be doing about the Media 1099 Book Club, and you're going to be figuring out what we're reading, what we've been up to. Robert, good morning. How are you, man?
Good. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing good. So has quarantine given you any more free time to start, like, killing off some of those books that you got stacked up on your shelf?
Yeah, no, it definitely has. I mean, it's one of those things of, I think you mentioned it, it's like, we have free time, but you hate that saying because our time is very limited.
True.
So for me, it's like, yeah, like everybody YouTubes and Netflix. Like I watched Last Chance You. I just watched The Last Dance. But there's something about reading that just, it's like, I feel more productive, you know? And it's also one of those things that helps me sleep better at night. You know, like if I read instead of watching TV, like, boom, yeah. I can fall asleep so much quicker.
That's true. I never really started to read at night, but I think that's probably pretty accurate. The thing I like about reading is that it's so in depth onto a specific topic. So if you want to watch like your 15, 20 minute YouTube videos, which are actually pretty long now, that's one thing. But to read an actual book on a subject, you're getting a lot of like meat on that bone there. That's what I really enjoy about it. Because so by the time you have completed that book, you really feel like, whether or not you can articulate it is another thing, but I think you really feel like you've grasped a lot that you didn't think about before.
Yeah, that, and I feel like it helps with concentration. You know, like it's really easy if you're doing the dishes and stuff to like watch something on YouTube. But when you're in a book, it's like you can't get distracted easily. If you do, like you have to set the book down, you know, and it really helps you, at least me, it helps me like stretch out my ability to concentrate for periods of time. Because after a while, you'll read and then you'll just be like, oh, yeah, I totally don't remember the last two pages. Like it just goes.
Yeah, that used to happen to me in school all the time, which is probably why I was such a bad student, is that like I'd be reading something and then I would stop and be like, you know, I don't really remember any of the last 15, 20 pages. Like I've just been reading words, but not actually processing anything. What I do now, and I have no idea how long you can kind of read in an actual book, but I just use kind of like these little timers and I kind of do these like little sprints. And if I feel like my optimal time is like 20 minutes, I kind of set it for 20 minutes. And that way I can just take a break, you know, take a walk around and then come back to it.
Yeah. I like reading like chapters, right? Like I hate getting stopped like halfway through.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
You know, like, but you know, life comes in play, and sometimes it's like, oh yeah, like my eyes are just kind of going. It's like they just put the bookmark in and live to read another day. But I'd say like I go in like half hour chunks to like anywhere if it's good and I want to get through something, like an hour, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And after that, then it just kind of just my eyes just blur over, and I'm like, I'm not retaining anything. It's just reading, just to read.
Yeah. And that's tough for you because you read like massive books, you know, you read big books. So like stopping in between a chapter and like, if you got like, oh, I got 60 pages left to the end of the chapter, you're like, I can't stop.
Yeah.
That's a tough beat.
Yeah. No, I mean, I try to find spots that like make it easier, but yeah, I do. Sometimes like, it's just like, dude, if it's a 60 page chapter, like you're going to stop at 20 pages left to go because ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And what I love about these book clubs that we do is that we have such different interests overall that it provides like this balance of like, oh, that's a very interesting kind of concept of a book. That's something that I might pick up or I may never pick up. And so I think this is really fun to kind of like break into for anybody. And I never really saw the value of having book clubs before, but now I kind of do.
Yeah.
So, and this isn't one of those things where we both read the same book and talk about it, although there's tremendous value in that. It's like, hey, what are you reading? You know, it's kind of like the same thing when you talk about, hey, what movies have you been watching? And if there's something that you know, if you're kind of a highbrow art film buff, you know, you can talk about, oh, you got to see this or you got to see this one, and then you talk about stuff. So that's kind of the cool thing.
What I love about this too is, I mean, there's like a million books out there, right? And there's like new ones published every day. So when you it helps curate for me, like when I get a recommendation from somebody else or they drop a book, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like if they say it's good, at least that like gives it a better chance of it being actually pretty decent. And then that's why, like, I chose the first book, Designing Your Life. It's kind of bad because it's backwards, I guess. But we talked to Aaron Anderson about this when we interviewed him, and he brought this book up, and I was like,
yeah,
cool, I'm going to write this down, because he had kind of talked about he was like living in San Francisco, and then he got this RV,
right,
and like kind of just shifted goals with his photography. And he said it kind of came into play after reading this book, and he reads this book every year or so. I was like, okay, cool. Like, that's a very good recommendation. I put it on my birthday wish list, and
nice,
you know, it magically came in from Amazon. I don't know. Thank you, my wife. so yeah, it was really good. And I it's weird. I've gotten into a phase of like semi-reading self-help books, you know, because I think one, I'm very cynical when it comes to that sometimes. So I'm very hard to like,
Skeptic.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical. That's a good way to put it. But this one, I think it was very pretty straightforward. It was just, I like it because it does have little like to-do things where it's like, hey, really write this stuff down and like think about it and don't just read it. I think it's okay. Which like the first time I read through it, I was like, okay, yeah, I'll get back to that. But
So did you read it twice?
No, I read it once. And then I went back and did the like actual like
notes
and stuff, because I tend, like, it was funny. I was going and like I was reading it and I was stopping and like doing it, and I was like, like the skeptic in me is like, I just want to see how this plays out before like I really jump into it, which I guess is bad on my part. But after going through it again and rereading the like, okay, this is why you're going to do it, like the parts that I highlighted, I was like, okay, yeah, like this is really good.
This is kind of a change of pace for you. Like, you usually don't bring up any self-help books, which is totally cool. Like, I think that's why it's kind of cool balance. And I the reason why I love self-help books is oftentimes is because it is actionable, and you can take something away from it. So it's something along the lines of, let's say, a book, which can be just by its nature rather reactive. And then you can turn it into something interactive. Like, you know, if it's saying like, hey, you know, try this. But yeah, it does require, I suppose, a sense of awareness of like, do I need this help? Otherwise, why am I going to read this self-help book, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I don't want to take up your time, but go ahead. Yeah.
No, but I think I've gotten better with that. Of like, look, no one has all the answers, and this person's put a lot of time to like write a book, and I take every book that's written with a grain of salt, because one, they're trying to sell a book and also help people, but. I think I've gotten better now that I've gotten out of like my early 20s. I'm just like, I know the world and everything, you know. But I always highlight stuff. So let me see.
Who's the author?
The author is Bill Burnett and Dave Evans. So they kind of, I think they're based out of like Stanford. They started working together in the same area of expertise, and they got together and started like, what are some of the questions and things that people always come up and away with? Sorry, I'm trying to find what I highlighted.
Sure.
One second. And so for anybody, I always like write stuff in my books. So I put little highlights of like interesting tidbits. You can see like the activities and stuff. So as you can see, that's how I go through it. I mean, I am a big proponent of taking notes and writing in the stuff. That's why it's really hard for me now to get books from the library, just because I can't like write in it.
You can't mess it up.
So yeah. I did in one of these books, I did take it out from the library, and like I did still put little sticky notes. So I think I'm going to like scan the pages and just add a little tidbit.
Yeah.
So
that's it. It is nice owning your own book so that you can do whatever you want.
Except it takes up too much space, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the other thing.
In this one, so they talk about like dysfunctional beliefs of things that you might think are true, or how you frame your perspective looking at something. And they talk about reframing it, you know, and how to adapt to certain changes and what are those things. And so a dysfunctional belief, you should focus on your need to find a job, right? Like, so you're going in like, I need a job. And they say to reframe it, you should focus on the hiring manager's need to find the right person, you know? So like,
right.
So it's like, okay, yeah, everybody needs a job. So you go into a job interview, like, oh yeah, I need this job. It's like, no, how can I solve your problem?
Yeah.
You know? And if you, like, no one likes to work with an asshole, you know, or if you come in with like, hey, look, I'm very flexible. These are my expertise. This is how I'm going to adapt and adjust. And you fix your boss's problem or the hiring manager's problem, like, you're way more likely to get hired, get that job, rather than like coming up, oh, I need this job. This is why I'm going to fit perfectly. You know?
I will spill the beans on one thing. You know, when you sent me this book that you're going to talk about, I actually started reading it this morning.
Oh, nice.
So, I killed off about half of it, you know, while I was making breakfast and cleaning up. And, yeah, like, so it's really cool. So, and that was one of the first things that came to mind was, you know, dysfunctional belief.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love like the actionable steps in this. I love the fact that they're talking about, you know, that this is, that life is an iterative process. And I think they even said right off the bat, like 3/4 of college graduates do not go into the field that they majored in their work. And so it's like this finding process of like, you know, what is going to make things valuable to you? What's going to bring your life meaning? I think that's a really great question that everybody needs to kind of ask. Is finding that.
Yeah, and they talk about like that balance of, you know, like people that are like, I want to be a doctor, like, coming out of high school, going to college. And then they find out like, oh, I really don't like this. You know, and then they have that battle of like, am I my work or am I like the outside? You know, and one of their to-do things is like, okay, where are you strong at? Like, are you really strong at balance or flexibility? Are you strong at your work? You know, like how much time are you putting there compared to your personal life? You know, because if you're held to the metal in work, like your personal life's going to suffer, you know, and you're not going to be able to survive in that environment for long. But if you're just doing nothing but your personal life and like, I like surfing and, you know, climbing mountains all day, like your work might suffer. So how do you find that blend of like, okay, maybe I'm a doctor right now, but do I want to be a doctor when I'm 50? You know, could I maybe... you know, help out with my, what I like to do, adventuring, mountain climbing, you know, so like, okay, cool. Could I maybe become a campsite, medical coordinator, you know, like be the safety person so I could go hiking and help kids learn how to do that. And I think this just really helped me in this like current environment of like, it's always good to reassess where you're at, you know, because everybody's goals are going to be shifting. My goals have definitely shifted from when I was in college to like where I am now. And that's not even that long of a period. And I know it's going to shift in 20 years.
You know, how so?
Well, I think like, it's weird. So like when I was first out of high school, I was like, oh, I want to be like the world's greatest sports photographer. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I still do, but now I look at the reality of that, like, in this book, they talk about changing gravity. Like, don't fight gravity.
Right.
It's there, you know, and part of the gravity situations is like the sports market is extremely saturated, right? And so because it's extremely saturated, you're not going to get paid as much. But you need the technology that's constantly shifting every 2-3 years. You need the top-of-the-line gear, lenses that are costing $10,000, 4 or 5 camera bodies. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, do I want to put myself in a risky situation where I have all this money invested or I go into debt to like chase this dream that is really long hours, hot days, like because I love sports, you know, and like I loved it more when I was in high school and college because like who doesn't? And now I'm like, oh, well, you know, like I love taking photos more and creating better memories of like what's a valuable photo. Before I used to think it's freaking going at USC, being on the sidelines and getting like, a future Reggie Bush, you know, jumping, hurtling over somebody. But now I'm like, well, yeah, but how many other photographers there are there getting that same shot? How different is my shot going to look compared to covering someone's wedding day? And it's like, dude, that photo is going to be there for that person for forever, for their family. And it's like, yeah, okay, I like this. And I don't need to drop $10,000 on a 600mm lens, you know?
Yeah. I think there's this notion, too, of just like feeling stuck. Like when you get into too deep on something, for instance, if you and this is the problem with I think education in itself is that it doesn't necessarily provide you with experience yet. It just provides you with the notion that if you go into this field, this is what it's going to provide, but you don't know until you get into it. And so if you go into law school and you go into pre-med or something like that, and then you're like, you know, before you know it, you're $400,000 in debt you know, into this field, and then you realize you don't actually like the work itself, you just like the idea of it, then you're kind of stuck. I think photography can be similar to that in the same way, where it's like, okay, what did you like about photography? And I think to this book, the thing that I really enjoyed, one of the aspects was, what do you call it? Like a good time journal.
Yeah.
I think is what they called it. And where it was just like, just start jotting down the times of your day where you're enjoying yourself. And this is the kind of the flow state, right? You know, which I know you're a big proponent of. You love flow, which is just when you are engaged immersively. It's play for grown-ups, as they say. And if you can identify when those moments are, it's not necessarily like the trade itself. It's like, what is the aspect of that that you enjoyed?
Yeah.
You know, is it just being creative is part of it? Or is it like, no, I need to be taking sports photography? Like, you know, you can kind of narrow this down a bunch of different ways and figure out like what actually drives you a little bit. And I was kind of along the same way where, you know, I wanted to go sports, and then I wanted to, I don't know, like, I think just overall, like, yeah, similarly, I was like, the return on investment is going to be very low for me. And I didn't find a way to like separate myself quite from the pack. I was like, you know, there's just way too many good sports photographers, way better than me. And I was like, but you know, there's these other niches that I'm pretty decent at, that are still itching that creative side of me. You know, like I'm still, you know, scratching that creative itch. So that was like kind of like this off pivot, but not that far.
Yeah, and I think this book kind of just helps you evaluate that, as well as like other aspects of your life. I mean, because like work is only one aspect of your life, you know.
Yeah. Right.
And it could be.
Did you do the dashboard?
Yeah, I did. I don't have it on me, but it was interesting to see where I feel like I was on certain things. For anybody that's not sure what we're talking about, I think we'll put a link in the description, because I think they do have links down that give you a printout.
I got one. Yeah.
Nice.
So you know, it's basically as far as I got, you know, that is,
yeah.
It was just like four different areas of your life that that you would basically do a self-assessment of.
Yeah.
If I'm getting this right. And so I did mine, and it's like, I had to be very honest, and I was like, okay, so health, 70%, that's kind of this mix of, was it your physical, your mental, and your spiritual kind of health overall? My physical health is probably like a zero, but like the mental and emotional and all that stuff, I was like feeling pretty good. Work is 80%. Correct me if I'm wrong, I got the sense that the work metric here is not so much about like, are you working right now? Because obviously right now things are compromised. So it would be 10% or whatever of that. But in terms of what the work is, how fulfilling is it? And so for me, I put it at 80%. I think the clients that I've shot for, I absolutely adore the people that I've gotten to meet, and it's provided me a lot of creativity. So I think that's great. I just want more of it because I'm greedy. the play is really what jumped out to me. I was like, I don't do anything that scratches that itch anymore. You know, I used to be a 5-handicap golfer. I loved that. That I always thought I was going to be playing every weekend until I died. And I haven't played in like 5 years. You know, it's like, that's to be good at something and then just give it up is unusual. But like, you know, that's kind of what sometimes happens once you get older. My love, I think, is 80%. I think it could be higher because I don't do a good enough job with my family, my direct family, you know, so like my parents, my niece, nephew, I need to do a better job with that proactively. But so that was a good thing to like let me know, you got to go play more. You got to do something. You got to go shoot some hoops. I mean, it's hard now, but you got to do something and emphasize that.
Yeah, was it kind of eye-opening like when you're like, okay, like all these numbers are pretty high, and then like play is like 10%.
I was like being realistic. I was like, you know, I wanted to put a number to it because I was like, oh, geez, it's pretty low. Yeah, I don't do anything that I think would satiate that specific area. So I need to work on that. That's the area. Basically, the whole concept is what area needs action.
Yeah.
And that's one of those areas where I'm like, I need to do that more.
Yeah. That's good that you're pretty honest with yourself. I feel like it's hard sometimes to be like extremely honest with yourself. And that's something I'm trying to work on constantly, because, you know, you grow up and you're like, oh yeah, everything you do is gold and rainbows. And it's like, oh, okay, cool. But then also like, how am I feeling about my work, or other aspects of what,
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I know you've mentioned this before, like you're a competitive person. Mm-hmm. I think it's just part of being competitive, and I wouldn't even classify myself as that competitive, but I do have like a pursuit of excellence. So that in that sense, yeah. And that's all this is, right? Mm-hmm. So like you can always be better at something. I could always be, if I consider myself to be like a 99 out of 100 type of husband, I want to get to 100. Yeah. I want to get, if I consider myself 100, I want to get to like 101. You know, that's just kind of, if I can, I'm going to try to.
Yeah.
Like during this quarantine, this is completely a lame thing to be proud of. I just started doing a Rubik's Cube.
Oh, nice.
You know? And so I watched that documentary on Netflix and I was like, oh my God, I want to try that. So I ordered a Rubik's Cube and learned how to solve it. And it was like taking me 5 minutes to do. And then it got to 3 minutes and then I got to like 2 minutes. And now I can do one. Like my record is like 1 minute and 9 seconds.
Oh, man.
And I was like, yeah. And so it just, and I'm like, this is super nerdy. But I was like, and my wife had to ask me like, why are you doing this? I was like, I don't actually have an answer for you. It's just because I can.
Yeah.
And if it can be improved on, then I'm going to try to.
Yeah.
And that's just part of it.
But also there's something about like, because it's a very physical thing. Like you see it and it's very, like, you put a stopwatch, like boom. I'm sure, I don't know. I've never been able to do a Rubik's Cube. I've never dedicated time to like, figure it out. The most I've ever gotten is like one side, right?
Right.
But then you're like, okay, 5 minutes. And then like you shave off to like 2 minutes. And then like that gap from 2 to 1 is like extremely hard, right? But it's something that like you physically do, you could mentally do, you could see like the progress in it. And I think learning how to redo that is like very motivating. And because it kind of hits all three things of like physical, mental, and like very time oriented. It's like, yeah, it's easy to get hooked into and it reteaches you how to pursue that into other things. You know, with like your play, maybe that's another 5%, 10%.
Maybe,
increase
yeah,
in
maybe
play,
you're right. Maybe I could pump that up a little bit.
And then you just
12%.
Like, okay, cool. Like, I relearned how to do something. You know, it's like trying to learn to throw a football left handed. Like, it sucks.
Yes.
But like, you do it after a while and you're like, oh, okay, this isn't as bad.
Right.
Okay, so switching gears, because I feel like that was a good topic. What was one of your books?
I don't know which one to start off with. Just because I have the hard copy version of it here, I guess I'll just start with this. This is called The Power of Zero.
Okay.
And so this is written by David McKnight, and it says how to get to the 0% tax bracket and transform your retirement. So obviously for some of you, it's going to be a snooze fest. for some of you, it's very interesting. I think the reason why I picked it up, and this is, you know, all stems from like, why are you picking up a book and committing X amount of hours to or whatever?
Yeah.
It's just one of those areas, I think, because I killed off my debts, you know, earlier this year, it was always the plan to, once you're doing that, now you can start to use that money that you were throwing away before, right? Like I was throwing $300 a month away to debt. Now what can we use that for so that the money will work for you?
Yeah.
And so then it started to become like, okay, well, what kind of vehicles can I put my money into? What is going to be setting myself up for retirement? This was actually recommended to me by a couple different CPAs. And so I read it, and basically this concept is about, you know, the genesis is that the U.S. government is spending trillions of dollars on programs that it really honestly can't afford, you know, to deliver on, the Social Security, Medicare, and all these things. And so basically the math says that the tax rates are going to have to increase, if not 2x, right? Like it's going to have to get higher. Now, if you don't believe that, that's fine. You can keep your money in kind of tax-deferred buckets, which I'm going to talk about. But for the most part, mathematically, it makes most sense to deliver on these promises by raising taxes, which, and I know you've talked about, you think the taxes are going to rise too. And so if you, based off of that, the issue with this is that most of us have our money in taxable and tax-deferred buckets, so that when it's time to take that money out, you're going to get taxed on it. And I think that's one of those areas where it's not saying like, you know, completely eliminate that, because there's absolutely uses for having CDs and savings accounts and, you know, 401ks, but it's understanding the appropriate amount to put in those, like do it up to the match, your employer match, but maybe not go any further.
Yeah.
And then can you find Roth IRAs or LERPs or, you know, those things that are tax free and move more of your money into that. So that way, because the numbers are in here are pretty crazy. When you realize like how much you could ultimately save of your money as opposed to paying extra taxes on it, like the RMDs, which is like your required minimum distribution on like 401ks is can be insane. And it's basically like a double tax. Mm-hmm. So when I see that and it's like, oh, that's, you know, they're taking 80%, you know, you're like, okay, God, that's brutal. I mean, it's your money. So why not just save as much as you can in that? And so it just got me thinking about all of those concepts about, you know, what, because you interact with all of them, right? So like a taxable account, which is, you know, your savings account, your checking account, like or whatever, anything that's creating a little bit of interest, that's great for like your emergency funds. But having $80,000 of it in there is completely wasting.
Yeah.
So, you know, have a certain amount that you can cover maybe a 3 to 6 month or a year long in terms of expenses and your emergencies. What can you do with your tax deferred, like I said, with your 401ks and move that over to a Roth or LERPs? And I think those are really important questions to ask. And you'd probably want to talk to your own CPA about this because your numbers are going to be specific. You know, how are you filing your taxes in general? What brackets are you in? But this overall, I think, and I had to read this twice. I listened to the audiobook and I read it twice. And I still am not good enough to articulate the book, but that's because it's just not a strength of mine. So I'm trying to work on all of the things that I kind of suck at.
Yeah.
And, you know, as somebody in my mid-30s or mid to late 30s, it's like, you know, you just kind of, these things become significantly more important to you because you know that you don't have time.
Yeah.
And I mean that with all sensitivity to somebody that's 56 and doesn't have anything in their retirement. Like, and I know I do have time, but I'm not 22 when you started this and you could really put yourself in great position. This is just one of those areas that I think is important. Brought some food for thought in terms of what I'm going to be doing with my own actionable steps.
Yeah, hopping in on that, like Ben Franklin's like compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. You know, where
yeah, right.
You know, because if like you said, if you're in your early 20s and you start reading those books and like, comprehending that, you have 40 years, you know, of 40-50 years of letting that compound just hit.
Where,
like,
right.
You know, once I heard some stats like once you exit your 30s, like. You don't. You can't get that 10% or like that doubling. Like it's there's smaller increments. You know, so it's like okay, cool. You need to throw in more money or make you know harder decisions. But any time, the best time was 5 years ago. But right. A good time.
The
is
second
now,
best time
is right
is
now.
Now.
Exactly.
Because it's never going to get better than now.
Yeah.
So it's only going to keep getting worse. So it's like yeah, absolutely. And so I think that's something that. You know, I've talked about with my wife and my CPA, and we've just developing kind of steps in place so that it's like, okay, you know, you cleared off your debt. Great. Like, what can we use now? It's like, what can we keep so that you still have an emergency fund? So we're not taking everything away and putting all of it into it. This is still suggesting the diversification, which I think is very important as well. Just keeping your financial, your fiscal health strong. Overall, and this is just an aspect of it. Obviously, the next one of the biggest aspects is like your income. Like, you know, can you make money? But this, in terms of specifically what to do with your retirement, is an important kind of, I'd say, seeking out process. Like, it's a search for how to do this. And this isn't necessarily like, you know, the end all be all. This is the answer. Like anything financially, I kind of try to read multiple things on the same topic to see, you know, where we're going to go with it.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna want to borrow that book after. Just
yeah. Like it's really cool to just and the excerpts are way too long for me to read one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it just goes on for like 2 pages, and you're like, but that was what a great 2 pages.
Yeah.
About like you know the Social Security history and like you know basically what it was intended for and how now the ratio is completely whacked so that we can't afford this. I just think it was really interesting to read. And so I enjoyed it. And it's actually relatively short. It's really like 90 pages.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah, that's not so bad.
Yeah. And so I think it's cool. Like I listened to it, but you know, when it comes down to figures, like numbers,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to listen to it and really kind of grasp what's being said. So I kind of did both. I read it and I listened to it.
Yeah, to jump on that as well, like another tax that's kind of unavoidable is inflation.
You know, yes, you're talking, absolutely. We talk about that in there too.
Yeah, because you were talking about like if you have $80,000, $100,000 just sitting there, like you're losing 2%. You know, that's what the government says is, and especially now, like you go out for food and food's costing more and more money. So food's costing more money, whatever is going to cost more money. So it's like, yay, that number might slowly go up with a 0.5% interest rate, but you're really losing 3%, 4%, 5%
a year. Yeah. Yeah. And that's not to say that you don't do it. It's just like, how much are you going to put into that?
Exactly. Right?
It's like, exactly. Yeah. So I thought that was good. I thought it was a useful read, and I think it's something that, I would definitely recommend people picking it up. You don't have to carry it as like the gospel. Just good insight.
To jump on that. So this book, The Forgotten Man,
it's a good transition right there.
Yeah. It was about the Great Depression and when Social Security was kind of put into place.
Right.
And kind of the hiccups and everything that kind of went with it, you know, because technically the Great Depression started when Hoover was in office. And then Roosevelt kind of let what was going on. Like, I'm a big American history buff, or not buff, but yet. But I like really reading about it because I think we constantly
repeat enthusiast. Themes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if there's a history on it, I kind of want to get my hands on it. And it's interesting seeing similarities back then to now. So I saw this come up on some podcast or YouTube video I was watching. I was like, okay, cool, I'll check it out. And there's very similar things going on, like exuberance in the market, and then it kind of just crashes. And there's this period of kind of turmoil of you're in between like elections, right? So people, like Roosevelt, wanted things to get worse because then that would give him, if he were to get elected, like more power, gives him more ability to come in with like a stronger hand. And I think we're in August right now when we're recording this. So like both of those powers of, it doesn't matter if you're left or right or whatever, but like they're trying to help, but I also think they're competing against each other. You know, I'm just very skeptical of government in general as an American. But yeah, so I got my hands on this book because I was like, okay, cool. Like I think we're by the numbers, we are entering the next Great Depression or the Greatest Depression. Our numbers are worse than the Great Recession, and we're only 6 months into this. You know, the Great Depression took 10 years to solve, and a world war kind of drug us out of that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, like, cool. I don't think it'll hurt to read up on some 1930s history.
I'm curious how much, because, you know, you learn about this in school. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're young, and then it's only maybe a segment of the curriculum that you spend on it. Like, how much do you think that you got out of this versus what you learned in school about the Great Depression?
I mean, drastically, a lot more. And also, like, I'm just going to say, like, this is, I wouldn't, like, it's a little right-leaning, you know, like, like, I could just tell from, like, the tone that they're going with. It's very anti-big government, you know, because this is the period when, like, the federal government started to really take over compared to states' rights, you know, and like that's kind of neither here nor there, but it's just traditionally like the Union, the Republic has been very states oriented. But in high school, it was just like, okay, World War One happened. We came in, we were champs, dominated that, you know, even though like from a military perspective, we didn't do too great of a job. We just had great numbers and we came in late and we just helped tip the scale. And then it was like the 20s came in, prohibition happened. There's all this flappers and like, women's liberation a little bit. And then the stock market was roaring and it just one day crashed because no one knows, you know, and then the 30s happened. There's a Great Depression. People were out of work. There was kind of union strikes. Communism kind of was talked about. Socialism was on the rise and then World War II came and we just kicked ass again. You know, like became the manufacturing king of the world. Like, and this book goes into that segment, like that 10 years very concisely.
Yeah, like that, was it 29 to 39 or something?
Yeah, pretty much.
How do you, if you're comparing it to your our situation now, you know, I think one of the big differences in terms of what I'm just seeing naively is that, you know, that there was so much big manufacturing going on then to get us kind of out of that. Is that right? Today, it seems like there's less of that. There's less, you know, there's the technology wise doesn't require you to really be a factory owner. Like you kind of have like resources all at, you know, your fingertips. How do you think that transitions, you know, now? I know there's similarities, but there's also probably advantages now that can maybe help. Who knows?
Yeah, I think there's two very similar things. One was like right at this time, like the mid-20s, like electricity was being brought to the cities, right? And so there's an advantage of living to the city because you could get electricity. But if you're out in the middle of Nebraska or Oklahoma, like you weren't getting electricity. And I feel like maybe a little bit more like 2-3 years ago, like the jump was, you know, if you live in LA, Orange County, New York, you have a great internet. You know, and yeah. If you could go out to the Midwest, like your internet speed's very slow.
Right.
And then that could kind of help with this online transition of starting your own business. Like, can you work from home? Can you interact with people online? Like, there's some technology shift there. But going to the manufacturing, yeah, there was a lot of manufacturing back then. Like Ford was helping with his Model T, lowering prices, increasing wages. Aluminum, steel was really big. But what's funny is that they kind of got so big that they were an easy target. Like I feel like a lot of rhetoric now is very similar to that. It's like these big companies are making huge amounts of money, like Jeff Bezos and Amazon and Facebook. Right. Right, it's like that tech. That like, this is the current technology trend, and they're getting richer when everyone else is getting poorer. And it's like, hey, that sounds very similar to Ford and you know, J.P. Morgan and all these guys of aluminum, steel, and electricity, or electricity like builders like Edison and the guys up in Chicago. And it's like, oh, like that rhetoric sounds very similar, you know. And it's like, it's very interesting to see how both sides are playing that, you know?
Like that's really interesting stuff. Like that's something that I would love to get my hands on. I just don't know if I want to commit to it. How long is that book?
This book is about 380 pages, give or take.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, it's not.
I was thinking that it was like a 1500 page book.
No.
Okay.
No, it's not that bad. Let me see. I want to see. Let me look up like a quick quote.
Yeah, because I mean, generally, you know, like I know that there's like a lot of depth to it because you're looking at not just that 10-year period, you're looking at the years prior and the years after. Yeah. And so it's like this window of like, you know, maybe 20 years or so that you're basically covering to determine like what happened and, you know, what are the trends that set that place and that moment in motion.
Yeah. And kind of like something that we talk about because we're always like, oh, you got to save. But also now we're like America's very service heavy industry. So let's see what the interviewers observed, especially with the Nazis, citizens were unhappy at receiving two opposing lessons from the governments. The first might be labeled saving, the private man's only safeguard. The second was spending, the nation's hope, right? Because it's like what happens in the Depression is everyone doesn't spend. So then one kind of can get new jobs, no one can, you know, and hence get wages and spend more. So it's like you have to save because you need to survive. Like you need to survive as an individual, but then as a community, you need to spend to get yourself out of that downward spiral.
Right.
So I think reading that was pretty interesting. Another like component is also like they were talking about like minimum wages and or maybe setting standards for like what people need to get paid here we go. Another big repeat was the government didn't want companies to fire people. And then that sounds very similar to what is happening right now with airlines, you know, the PPP programs, you know, and there's pros and cons to that because people have their jobs still until the end of September, if you're in the airlines, or October.
Mm-hmm.
But then it restricts businesses from like doing what they have to do. It's kind of like close down a little shop a little bit to save the whole shop. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what the right answer is. I'm not going to be a politician, but it's just one of those things of like, hey,
Right.
That was going on back then, and it's going on right now. You know, there's pros and cons of each.
I think the cool thing about these types of books, even if it is pushed, you know, right or left, to some degree, is that, you know, presuming that there's the majority of truth to it, you can just take facts, and then you can determine what you think is maybe the best methodology to get to, you know, back to form. And that's always kind of nice about, you know, historical facts. It's like, okay, this is what happened. Yeah. You know, this is agreed upon or whatever. So yeah, I think how would you rate that book? I mean, you don't have to give me a number, but like, you know, how would you recommend that to people?
I would say, look, like if you have an idea of repeat history, like it doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, you know, like that Mark Twain quote, I think, like if you enjoy that, I would pick up this book.
Yeah.
You know? And even if you are a proponent of like government solution and like, that's going to spur it, like that's fine, but you should always hear counter arguments.
Right.
And then if you're like, no, like you need to pull yourself up by the bootstraps and somehow that's going to work, then cool, listen to this to counter those arguments or like reinforce those arguments. I'm not saying here nor there is either, because everyone has their own views, you know, and I think it's going to be a mixture of both. I think going back to the 20s and 30s, it was, you get in the situation where the government has to step in, because if people aren't eating, like it's going to be a problem. Something that was a saving grace kind of back then is people didn't have as much debt. Like the middle class was very much more strong.
You know? Yeah. Right.
So even though they had less, they were like, and the quality of life wasn't as good because they didn't have as much technology and comfort. They were like somewhat stronger, and that helped bridge the gap of like what do we call civil unrest that's currently potentially doubling.
Okay.
You look at graphs of, you know, like the top 1% owns X amount, and the bottom 50% owns like 2%. So like that was closer. So we're in a similar situation, but we're also in a very different situation.
Right. I like that quote by Mark Twain. You said.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one actually. That's
okay. Yeah, pretty, if you look,
it's pretty wise.
If you look, man, like there's stuff that, you know, it's, and there's a whole theory of like every 100 years or 80 to 100 years, like each generation kind of dies off, right? You know, and like, so they have like four seasons of America where you go through like World War II would be like the hero stage, and then you have like the next expansion generation stage, like it was the space age, Kennedy, then you go into like a turmoil stage. And so there's all these like why history in America is constantly repeating, I guess throughout the world. But that's a little bit put on your tinfoil hat a little bit, but it's still very interesting. You know?
Yeah. So very cool.
Alright, throw it back to you.
The next book that I'm going to talk about is called The E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber. Okay. This is really a book that's dedicated towards small business owners. And I definitely recommend this one. This one was more of a like a real thought-provoking book for me, because my business is obviously very different than what he's talking about. But at the same time, as a photographer, it's important for me to start thinking about these aspects, to start thinking about how can I become more entrepreneurial. So one of the big takeaways that I had from this book was how to build a business that is more systems-dependent as opposed to people-dependent. You know, if I am not there, my business doesn't exist, right? So that's what all of us creatives tend to face. So, you know, how can that be down the road or whenever be something that I look into so that I can sell the system, you know? And you don't have to have an exit strategy for just being a freelancer, but, you know, just knowing that there is something like called an exit strategy, I was like, oh yeah, I didn't really think about that. Mm-hmm. You can sell the business. You don't have to sell, it's not the product. And one of my favorite takeaways from this is these three kind of roles that he classifies that every small business owner basically inherits. And every small business actually needs these three roles. And they are the entrepreneur, they are the manager, and the technician. As, you know, one person operations, we inherit all three of them, but the amount of between each one of them is different. So the entrepreneur is, as you can expect, the visionary. It's like the person that creates the opportunities. It pushes business towards new visions. Mm-hmm. This person is like a dreamer, and it's a catalyst for change. Without the business, without this person, there would be no innovation. So there's the importance of the entrepreneur. The issue with that is that sometimes the ideas come faster than the actual ability to execute those can be put into place. Therefore, you need the manager. And the manager is like, okay, the entrepreneur is driving me crazy. It's like, you know, the ideas are too fast and too furious. I got to like rein this in and manage it and create a system for it. That's what the manager is there for. Without the manager, you actually wouldn't have a business. And the technician is the craftsman. That's the person that knows how to do the thing that you're supposed to do. In my case, photography.
Yeah.
And this person is, you know, if you had to categorize all three of these categories, the entrepreneur is living in the future, the manager is kind of living in the past, and the technician is just living in the present. Like, what do I have to do right now to do this? And so you need all of these aspects. Like, you can't have a business without any of them, right? You need all three of them. What happens is that the majority of the time, small business owners tend to be, as he states, I think 70% technician, 20% manager, and 10% entrepreneur. And the issue with that is that the technician is not the person that needs to be in charge, and that's generally what ends up happening. So the idea is that, you know, when you are an expert at something, you just start a business at it because you're an expert at baking pies or, you know, fixing a car. Yeah. Does not mean that you know how to set up your own auto shop and create a business for it. And so all these thoughts were really interesting because it's like the fundamental misconception is that if you understand the technical work of a business, you'll understand the business that does the technical work, which is not true. So the answers to all these questions are hard, right? And it's hard to find it. And it depends on your profession, of course. But this really got me into thinking about a number of scenarios, a number of case studies where you talk about somebody who, you know, bakes cookies, for instance. And it's like, I know how to do this, but I didn't know how to do any of the other things. And so it just forces you to think about those aspects, to think about like, okay, you know, what can I do to create one, a more systems-based operation as opposed to me being there? And, you know, how much of the technician am I? How much of the manager am I? How much of the entrepreneur am I? And I do believe that there is this push towards to be becoming more of the entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't need to be like a flip-flop. It doesn't need to be 70% entrepreneur, but there needs to be more than that 10%. And if I'm being very honest with professions like ours, whether you're a graphic designer, a photographer, a sculptor, I don't know, it's probably like 95% technician.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, and then like 4% manager and then like 1% entrepreneur. But of course, there's examples of people doing tremendous things that I think are very entrepreneurial and very innovative. And so I think there's this checks and balances, right? Like I know if I had to put kind of like I did with the other chart and that dashboard, if I had to put percentages on it, like, I mean, it's probably pretty close to that. It's probably like 75% technician, you know, 15% manager, and then the rest, whatever's left over is the entrepreneur. So I do need to work that area and give it a little bit more TLC for sure.
Yeah, I agree with the numbers of like entrepreneur to manager to technician, because I do think we just like it's a craft where, and we do think we're entrepreneurs, but I'm curious, what is the like definition to him of an entrepreneur in that book? What is, if you had to give a brief description, what would that be?
So it would probably go on for several chapters. Mm-hmm. But I would say kind of like I mentioned before, where I was basically saying that, you know, this person is what pushes and innovates.
Okay, yeah.
You know, so that's the visionary. So if you have, let's just call it like the auto mechanic, you know, and it's like, that's the technician basically. And then you need to build an operation system for the manager who would be able to handle payroll and handle inventory and handle all of these other things. But then the entrepreneur is like, well, how do we make this multi-city? How do we build this to becoming a brand that's not just, oh, John's Auto Mechanic Shop? You know, it's like those innovative decisions that can take you from being just another, you know, transmission place on the block to, like, no, that's the transmission place that becomes a franchisee or something.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, in all of us, we have the capacity for every single role. It's just, to what degree are we showing the most attention to? And that biggest thing to me was, you know, like, that notion of, okay, and I think it's really good for, let's say, students, for people that are starting to do second careers, like, I'm good at something. I'm really good at, you know, photography, just because it's the example that I'm immediately thinking of. Then I can become a photographer. It's like, you might be able to. It's a good system to have, but at the same time, what can you do to make that business sustainable, and how can you drive it forward so that you're not just another contractor?
Yeah.
And I think these are all questions that maybe this book doesn't necessarily answer for you, but it be by provoking you with the questions in itself was really valuable.
Yeah, no, I think that's like the best books that just make you like stop and reflect, like, oh yeah, how much of a manager or technician am I? You know, and even in life, like, to put that, like, another spin on that is like, okay, how much in my life am I just going from day to day? Like, I like how you said the entrepreneur is thinking of the future, manager is thinking of the
yeah.
past, and like, the technician is just like, yeah, we're solving today's problems and making sure the ship doesn't sink, you know? And I like
and the funny that. Thing is, and he talks about it, it's like, the reason why these things are so hard sometimes is because they're all in conflict with each other. They're all getting in each other's way.
Yep.
You know, like the everyone's getting in the technician's way. It's like, no, I need to focus on this and get this done. The manager's like, you know, the entrepreneur is moving way too fast, and, you know, we haven't created an infrastructure for it, and, you know, everybody else is not moving fast enough for the entrepreneur. So everybody's kind of getting in each other's way, and that's a really good analogy in terms of what's actually going on internally when you start your own business, when you become a freelancer and decide, I want to be, you know, Michael Durr Photography, like, this is going to be my actual profession, not just something I do on the side on the weekends. And, you know, you're combating yourself and you're like, okay, well, how do I become a better business person? How do I become more innovative? How do I become more research oriented so that I can actually build a system? You know, do I have an exit strategy? Do I have any of these things in place? And I think these are really good questions to ask yourself.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to be another book that I'm like, oh, okay. Because did you listen to this on an audiobook, or was it a physical?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
And it's been recommended by several other books that I can't remember reading, but this book had always been like alluded to, like in Michael Gerber's, you know, The E-Myth Revisited, you know, it alludes to this. And so I kept thinking, like, okay, well, now I got to see what this book is. And I really enjoyed that analogy and that tiered breakdown of what a small business really kind of needs to run. It was pretty eye-opening and interesting.
Yeah, no, I think for me, I'm trying to think of like what my numbers are. Like, I'm definitely technician heavy. I think this podcast has helped with the entrepreneur side.
Like, yeah, yeah, which is good.
Yeah, yeah, and like, that was part of the reason why we wanted to do this, right? It's just like, okay, let's branch out. Let's how do we expand our voice, our footprint? You know, and then right. it's weird because now it's like it's slowly turned to a manager type of thing of like, okay, what's our system of getting content out, you know?
Yeah.
And constantly, okay, so now that system's in place, the entrepreneur is like, hey, let's do video. Let's do all this other cool
yeah,
stuff.
Right,
and
right.
we're just like, well, you know, let's figure this out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
piece by piece, you know, you're building a house.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely, that's pretty good. All right. I think for my last book, for me, is Market Mind Games. The reason I picked this book up was because during COVID, you know, just like everybody else, hopped on that stock market train, you know. It was like I think everybody was like, oh crap, all my business is shut down, let's open, you know, for 5 days a week. It's like, oh, stock market. And so of course with anything I think that you jump into, you should try to read as much as possible. And this is also kind of like a psychology, sociology book, which I think always tickles my fancy a little bit. So it was pretty interesting. It talks about how your beliefs can kind of obscure what is really going on, like distort your vision, you know, because like having a belief in anything, right? Like in this book, it's like the market's going to go up, and it's like, because you have a belief, you have some stomach behind it, you have some energy behind it, like you assume a lot of things, you know, like,
yeah.
Oh, well, I assume because it's a Tuesday, like every Tuesday the market goes up, or, you know, this good news is going to come up. Or it's like, well, you got to really check your assumptions before you start making these decisions based off of that. And it really just like take a step back and evaluate yourself so that you can evaluate others a little bit better. And I think for me, like, it translated into kind of photography as well, as like when maybe new fads or something like come into play, and it's like, oh, you know, everybody's throwing on gels and I need to do this. Like, am I hopping on late on the train, or am I hopping on too late, or I mean too early, you know? And it's like, you know, because you always want to be like, everybody wants to be the trendsetter, you know, and everybody wants to be kind of top of the line in their field. But it's like, no, you need to not be chasing that tail all the time, you know?
And it's hard to do both. Usually the innovators don't necessarily end up becoming the best version.
Exactly.
You know, people iterate off of that because it's like they see, okay, there's groundbreaking stuff, I'm going to perfect that. So it's hard to be both.
Yeah. And it talks about kind of, you don't need to, like, you don't want to be too far ahead of the curve, right? Where it's like, if you have this realization, and this is a little bit different because, like, we're very, our own industry based, but in this is kind of like the market. So this is talking about like groups of people is, okay, you could be right, but if you're right before everybody else notices that you're right, like that stock, let's say you, okay, the stock's going to go up, right? And you're like, I know it's going to go up because the fundamentals, but you're in it 2 weeks before everybody else notices. Like, that stock could go down and down and down, and you're just like, oh, I'm holding, what's going on? And so it's like, oh, well, if you could start to realize when other people are going to start to realize, like, oh, hey, maybe, like we were talking about earlier, like, oh, hey, maybe, like, sports photography isn't the best market to be entering because everybody else wants to be entering, you know? So kind of like pump the brakes on that a little bit and just reassess your mindset of why you're going into that. Because it's fun, it's great.
But it's like, right.
Like, oh, no, well, maybe everybody else is thinking that. Maybe I should step back and look at the business side of it.
So psychologically, what else are, or is what did you notice from this book in terms of like what's the trend that people end up doing? Is it jumping on and trying to being the trendsetter like right away and getting in on something early? Is that the biggest?
Well, yeah, I think it's assuming that your assumptions are right, and then also, so like people get stuck in this mindset of, you know, like going back in to my other book of like, okay, we're in this Great Depression. The only way to get out of it is Keynesian economics and spend, 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 spend. And it's like, okay, but why? Like, why do you assume that that is going to be the best way? And like, so you have to look at all your assumptions before you make a decision. Another thing is like FOMO, like fear of missing out, is like people will see the train taking off and like, let's say a stock's kind of going up and up, and you're like, oh God, this is like, it's a new paradigm. It's a new shift. You know, like I need to hop on it before it goes. And it's like, well, cool, but you're already late. Like if everybody's going on and something's too good to be true, then like don't hop on it, because you could make a lot of money, but you could also lose a lot of money. And I think people get caught up in that as well.
Did this book give you more actionable advice in terms of like how you're going to handle your own investments, or is it more just affirmations of what you already knew?
I would say that it made me re-look at what I define as risk. You know, like what is my risk reward ratio? You know, because
that's very valuable, by the way, just to identify what's risk, what true risk is, and you know, that's I think a very valuable skill.
And your biases, like part of this book too, is like handling your emotions. You know, because that's like that's like the worst thing. It's like everybody likes to win, right? But it hurts a lot more to lose. Like some people, for me, like it hurts more to lose than to win. So some people react to things differently, but it's like, okay, let's say you have you're having a fight with your wife and like you get less than ideal sleep and you haven't worked out and you ate bad food, like all these things that are your biochemistry, like you're angry because maybe, you know, you got rear-ended by somebody, like, oh, I have this lack of control in my life. And so like impulsively you want to kind of like, okay, I can take control of this purchase, this stock purchase, this camera equipment, whatever. And then you're not assessing all the risk because you're just like, no, I need to take action and control my life because I've gotten out of control. And so then you will hop into some bad investment and then it'll maybe start to tank on you and you're just like, oh crap, I'm going to double down because like, no, I'm right. Like, I know I'm right. And you're like, no, dude, you're just your lack of sleep, not thinking right, you have bad food in you, and all these things are not allowing you to see the risk or the reality. Your reality field is distorted, you know?
Yeah,
I mean? Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just because you think and assume that it's going to go up doesn't mean it's going to. You know, you got to follow the trend.
Exactly. How long is this book?
It's not too long. I would say it could be like 220 pages. It's kind of, it's weird because like my critique of it, it kind of has like this weird like fake love story kind of entwined that like these people meet, like the person who writes it, Denise Shula, she like talks about how she met like the future husband by doing these presentations. And I was like, okay, like it's cool. Like it's your own book. Like you're going to do it. It could have been semi unneeded. Like it shows like they're contrasting like ideas of what right is.
Gotcha.
And like how eventually, you know, they're both right type of BS. But like, but it was good. Like the stuff in it was good. It was just, it wasn't.
And this would be a book that's already for people that have investing experience, not so much a beginner's how-to.
Yeah, this isn't something that is like, oh, here's the fundamentals of investing.
Right.
This is more of like how to keep your emotions in check and realize that like sometimes you're going to lose. And and even when you win, like it's something that I realized in this is like even when you win, there's still winner's regret, right? So let's say there's a stock that's going up, right? And like you bought in at the right time, stock's going up, and you're like, oh, it's time to sell, right? And you're like, but there's two possibilities of like, do I sell too soon and then I miss out on future profit or more profit, right?
Yep.
Like there's that regret. And then there's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm going to hold on because this ship's never going to end. And then it dips and you're like, damn it, I could have sold off and made like $500 more, right? So like no matter what, even though you won either way, you're going to lose mentally either way. So like you have to be willing to accept that.
And it feels like poker.
Yeah. Right. And it's just like, you're like, oh, crap. Okay. Like it makes sense, but to really like look at it and reflect on your emotions and just like let that sit. Like a lot of people, this book talks about is like, we're very, at least for men, we're like, don't trust your emotion. Like just look at the facts and like,
yeah.
And then this book is like, no, like, look at how you're feeling. Look at how your emotions are. Look at what food you eat or how much exercise and like, how does that affect how you feel and how your feeling is going to affect the consequences of your decisions. You know, so it's kind of like a deep dive into yourself so that you can make better decisions because, you know, like the stock market and in life, like, it's a probabilities game. Like life is chaos, you know?
Yeah.
So you're not going to be able to control and make the right decisions all the time. But if you could reflect and like, yeah, even though I lost on that, like it was still the right decision to try that. Or, oh damn, dude, I didn't have a good night's sleep. I was pissed, and I wanted some form to like, yeah, I controlled the destiny of my life, and I shouldn't have taken that gamble.
Yeah, no, I, all of these things are really important skills to have. And when you talk about like the power of zero, we're talking about money market games. What is it?
Market mind games.
Market mind games. Yeah. Is this notion that, you know, it's not so much discipline. I think it's just awareness of, you know, what's going on out there. And, you know, when it comes to money, I think you do want to be careful with it. You know, it doesn't mean that you specifically have to be very reserved. You can be aggressive with things, but just understanding all the angles as best you can, I think is really important because it is your money. And so nobody wants to throw that shit away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Do you have one more book?
And this was it's a self-help book. And I think there's a lot of really good value to it based off of like how to improve your relationships with people, which you obviously know, even in a quarantine situation, is still at an all-time high in terms of importance. Like you need to communicate with people. Like I'm going through negotiations right now. Mm-hmm. I have a client that's trying to, after the fact, lower the rate. You know, like these are things that are important to like understand how you want to interact with people. Even you and me who have different ideas about like, you know, the podcast, like how do you optimize this relationship, your life partner, your parents, all of these aspects I think are really, really important and it can really save you a ton of stress. So my favorite aspect of this book was, and then the reason why I guess I picked this book up is first and foremost, because I just think a fundamentally flawed human being. But that being said, like, you know, the best part of it was really this notion of breaking down personality traits and speed reading people as best you can. Now, I'm not good at it, but I just having read the book was really interesting about how you can decode people's personalities, whether it's your boss, your coworker. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, like, why is this even important? And I suppose it's like, you know, have you ever tried to fix somebody and try to get them on the same page? It's like, oh, if only my boss were this, you know, then it'd be great. Or if only my employee would be like this, then we could actually get shit done. Or if only my partner would do this. And that never works out, that mindset.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't work out trying to fix those people or hope that it does. Instead, it's more of like decoding what type of personality traits that you exhibit. And you can do this by creating kind of a map in itself right off the bat and trying to analyze that. But you can also do it based off of asking specific questions and figuring out, okay, this person is exhibiting this. Therefore, maybe I don't send you an email list that's super long if you're the type of personality that's going to be overwhelmed by that.
Okay.
And just that notion in itself is going to be able to create a better work-life balance. And that's kind of generally why I read it. It was more for work-life balance. I think I get along with my wife enough, you know, right now. But still, at the same time, you know, I read this book and there's these five-factor models of like the personality traits of like openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And it's like, I think about all of these aspects, and if only my parents knew my personality better, things would have been so much different. And if only I knew this stuff back then, like life would have been so much easier growing up in my household, because my mom is a high neurotic. Mm-hmm. I would classify, you know, and high conscientiousness, which is basically your ability to get things done. Like, how organized do you need to be?
Okay.
Right? Like, do you need a plan? I ranked and I did the personality test online and everything like that, which I think is always a really cool idea for you to do, because when you're working with people, it's good to understand where people kind of are.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm relatively low on that scale. Like, I don't need to have plans in place. I almost never have a plan. I only plan for people that are high conscientiousness.
Yeah.
That's why I do it. That's why I do call sheets. It's not for me. It's for other people. And so it's like understanding that not everybody is going to react the way that you react. Because if it were up to me, I'd be like, hey, guys, we'll figure it out on set. But then that's like imposing what I want on them.
Yeah.
And that's not fair. So, and she talks about this with her interns, and she's talked about with people that have worked with her. And it's like, why can't this person perform these tasks? And it's like, oh, well, maybe because I did send her and overloaded her with options. And because she's high agreeable, she's going to say yes to everything. But instead, she ended up quitting like a day after because
yeah.
it was too much for her.
Okay.
And this could have all been avoided just by simply understanding each other and understanding these things. So I think these are really cool aspects that are really interesting to me. And I was like, okay. And I don't know if you've seen the show Parks and Recreation, which is a comedy. It's still on Netflix, but you know, there's a notion in there for anybody that's watched the show. It's very popular, where Leslie Knope throws a party for Ron Swanson, but she says at the end, "Why would I throw Ron Swanson an Ann Perkins party?" And basically, the gist of it is like, you know, they are completely different people, and understanding how different they are allows you to tailor your actions towards those people,
mm-hmm.
and therefore create an experience that's easy for everybody,
yeah.
so that person's not overwhelmed by like having a ridiculous party with balloons and all this stuff. If that person's a low extrovert, you just don't do those things. And so you're reading these people based off of questions, based off of actions, and you can try to do it as fast as you can. It's a generalist, you know. It's not like you're not going to be 100% right all the time, because there are layers to people. But it's just one of those aspects where you're doing your best you can, an educated guess
yeah.
based off of information.
No, was that list or that quiz, is that like you need a copy of the book, or is it kind of like an open source type of thing?
I don't think you need to own the book.
Okay.
I can probably just put the link in and people can and try it out.
Yeah.
And you can see where you rank in terms of the five factors of your personality traits. And again, those are openness, which is how open you are to approaching new ideas. That's a big one to note, because not everybody's going to be that way.
Yeah.
I've worked for people that are pretty reserved, pretty low on the list. I'm pretty high on that list.
Mm-hmm.
So just knowing that, how forward am I going to be coming to that person with a new idea that's going to revolutionize something, but then they're going to be like not very receptive to it.
Yeah.
And then this relationship is kind of on the rocks. Conscientiousness, which I talked about, which is your organizational factors. Extroversion, which you kind of know, you know, like where do you rank on extroversion? Like I ranked actually, ironically, I always consider myself an introvert, but I kind of ranked a little bit on the higher side of that. And that's going to have a very, you know, big impact in terms of like, you know, putting somebody on the spot. If they don't like being in that position,
yeah,
then don't put them in that position.
Yeah.
Agreeableness and neuroticism is like, you know, your approach to worry, right? So some people like, and I think, and I don't know if I'm accurate on this, like, again, this is a generalization here, but like, you know, I tend to think of you as somewhat low on the neuroticism level. Like you don't worry as much as I do.
Yeah.
Like I have a tendency to worry more. And so sometimes you might be like, why are you like worrying about this? And then I'll be like, why aren't you worrying about
yeah,
this? And then it's like, so just understanding that, like, you know, I do rank high. I'd probably put that pretty damn high.
Yeah.
You know, so those are attributes that just understanding where people are, that empathy level, I think is actually pretty transformational, because then the frustration level subsides a little bit.
Yeah.
It's like, got it.
Yeah.
Mike needs to worry about this. And because it's like that same thing. If you ever try to calm somebody down that always worries too much, it's like, it's not going to work.
Yeah. It's like shaking up a soda more. Like it's going to make it worse. Yeah. I think, I do think I'm pretty low on the like worry scale. It is funny mm-hmm. sometimes when you're like prepping for interviews or something and you're just like, I'm like, dude, like chill. Like we got this.
It's like,
you know,
and I'm like, no, I just need to be, make sure everything is good. And,
yeah. But yeah, I do think it's interesting seeing one, like yourself. Like I always think you got to know yourself before you know other
yes.
people, you know, because yeah. that helps you realize how you react to situations and stuff. But I think it's interesting that it gives you like a little bit of a quick playbook to like maybe see
right.
what other people are and like, oh, okay, cool. Like I'll shift my approach to just make this situation better. You know, like we were saying, like, you know, people that's, or a person that's not an extrovert, like don't put them on the spot. You know, and like I've learned that the hard way of like, I had once like intern assistant that was like, I guess not very extroverted, which I'm used to. And I was just like, no, like, hey, like, okay, go here and like show this person kind of like I'm going. They're like, they kind of tensed up and I'm like, oh, that was a mistake. You know, like,
right.
okay, like I should know better, you know, cause like, this is my shoot.
That is absolutely where it starts. It starts with your self-assessment first.
Yeah.
And then you start to assess and you start to like draw out these maps. And I'm starting to do this too with like my parents and like my brother and just think like seeing, okay, where would I put them? And this is why, you know, some friends, right, are super easy, but some friends will never call you back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, instead of being frustrated with it, just understand what that person actually might rank and what where they might be. And you don't have to put all of your eggs into this, you know, quiz basket. But it got me thinking about a lot of those aspects. And it's the same thing with personal relationships, too. And they go further with kind of these love languages and what you see in terms of what you actually perceive as, like, your greatest sign of love.
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, it's, like, physical affection. Some people, it's gifts. Some people, it's a service, like, I'm going to do the dishes for you. I'm going to fix your car for you. Like, that's the biggest show of love that I can give you. Some people, it's just quality time. And so understanding where people prioritize what, like, I may be making you meal. Like, I do this with my wife all the time. She needs physical affection, mm-hmm. like, more. You know, we're and this is a guy thing, too. We I think, tend to be horrible at non-sexual affection. You know, just like just, you know, it's just, you know, a 10-second hug or whatever it is that can be that much more meaningful than me cleaning the entire kitchen for her or whatever. So, but those are different love languages. And I tend to think that way when I'm like, well, if I make this meal, that's the greatest show of affection or that's the greatest show of love. But she may be seeing something a little bit different.
Yeah.
So to me, it was more just assessing and being like, oh, I didn't actually think about that. I just thought everybody thought the way that I do,
yeah.
which is obviously, you know, not true. And I was like, Okay. So it, to me, people reading, getting better at working with people. Like I said, I'm a tremendously flawed person. I don't do very well with a lot of relationships over the course of my life. Only until lately have I been better at it. But this is something I think really helped me. And it's absolutely a book that I will probably try to read every year.
Okay.
Because it's a lot. It's a lot, yeah. You know.
No, I mean, yeah. Dude, I think you have books now that I'm like, okay, you've recommended this. I think we get along. All right, I'm going to have to steal a couple of these books from you. You know, if we could ever get out of quarantine and meet up at some point and do a book exchange.
That'll be a good day, you know. Like, I mean, and I've talked to people about this. You know, I was talking to Mike Goulding when we did the interview, and I was like, I hope we can crush a beer one of these days together, yeah. Instead of like, you know, jumping on the phone call. And absolutely the same with you. Like, this is, it's been long enough, but you know, we're going to do what we have to do.
Yeah. So, do you have any final thoughts kind of to wrap things up?
No, read, people. I mean, this is it's a great exercise for your mind. I honestly believe that sometimes if I have absolutely nothing going on, if I didn't reach out for a prospective client, if I didn't make some sort of piece of art, if I read, you know, even let's say half an hour to an hour, I feel so much better about my day, which I think is tremendously valuable. And in times of quarantine, and when this shit happened, when this stuff went down, there was a meme about it, about like how extroverts were just absolutely losing their minds. Because again, like a low extrovert, for instance, like is loving quarantine where they can just sit down and read a book. And then a high extrovert's like, no, I need people. I need to be around people. They're driving themselves insane.
Yeah.
But I think that this, it's a time where mental stability can be compromised to a degree. I think people are having issues. I know that from my own personal relationships where people are you know, hanging in there, but you know, it's tough. And I think books can be a really good ally.
Yeah, no, I'm going to leave it as like, it's a good way to not have a time waster. Like, I've never read a book and just like, oh, that was a waste of time. I found to the point where like I'll read part of a book and be like, oh no, I'll throw that away. I've gotten more comfortable with like, no, I don't like this book, I don't think it's valuable. But I do think like, one, I'm a proponent of like, it will help you sleep. Like, if you're having issues, like, do you turn off your phone and just read for half an hour and then your eyes will just slowly want to go to sleep. Also, history, you know, rhymes all the time. Like, be the manager of, look to the past to see what's going to happen in the future to help your entrepreneurial self, you know, and it's fun, dude. Like, it's fun. I always recommend books. If you have recommendations, shout it out to us, because like, that always helps curate the unlimited amount of books that there are in the world, you know. So
I think, you know, really quickly, like, I think what we'll maybe just end up doing is we'll provide this on the Media 1099 website. Mm-hmm. Let's just compile a list of our book recommendations for freelancers and entrepreneurs. And if you get anything out of it, like, cool, you know, we don't have any affiliate links. It's just a book list. And if you guys enjoy it, you know, awesome.
Yeah. And then who knows, maybe we could actually start a little bit of a semi-book book club, you know, and we could discuss and become part of that bourgeoisie class.
yeah. You know, super bougie.
So I think it's been great. That's going to wrap it up for us today. If you've enjoyed the podcast, give us a like where you've listened to it. Also, don't forget to check us out on YouTube, on our channel, where this video will be up there, uploaded, so you guys can check us out. Don't forget to follow us at Media1099Podcast on Instagram, or check us out at Media1099.com for all the latest updates. I'm Robert Husky, here with Michael Burr, and we will catch you on the next episode.